walk across the courtyard towards the library. I can hear the insects buzz and the leaves beneath my feet.
Good evening, Kodiak, and welcome to another episode of Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA. My name is Athenia, and I'm host and producer of Dog-Eared Reads, along with the chair of the Kodiak Public Library Association. Today, we have a wonderful show for you. Local author James Rains has done a fantastic interview with international best-selling author Christopher Paolini. Christopher Paolini wrote the Inheritance Cycle books, the flagship book of which was Aragon, which was also made into a movie in 2006. Christopher Paolini spent some of his childhood living in Alaska and recently came back to visit Anchorage and Fairbanks and do a book signing and small presentation on his books for his longtime fans. He joins us today to talk about the Inheritance Cycle books as well as his future plans for a science fiction novel. It's a wonderful interview that takes up most of the hour of Dog-Eared Reads, but after the interview, I do have time for one small book review, also geared to those fantasy novel fans out there. So if you like fantasy novels, if you like the Inheritance Cycle books, if you're interested in Aragon or dragons or fantasy in general, today is the show that you want to be listening to. So let's get to it here on Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA. To defy the beauty, the good Lord put in there. Simple. Welcome to Beyond the Cover, our segment in Dog-Eared Reads, where we interview authors, musicians, and other performers traveling Alaska or visiting Kodiak with their work. Today on Beyond the Cover, we're interviewing Christopher Paolini. His work includes the international bestsellers Aragon, Eldest, Brisinger, and Inheritance, along with Aragon's Guide to Alagaseya. Christopher Paolini was born in 1983 in Southern California. Throughout his childhood, he occasionally lived in Alaska, as well as Montana, where he now currently resides. At the age of 15, Christopher Paolini wrote Aragon, the first book in the Inheritance series. The self-published version of this book was released by the time he was 17 years old and became an overnight success before it was picked up and published again by Random House. He then spent the next decade writing and touring with the following three books of the series. Christopher Paolini recently came back to Alaska after a 25-year break to visit it again and to do a book signing and speaking event for his books in both Anchorage and Fairbanks, as well as doing an interview with Dog-Eared Reads about his amazing life, beginning a professional writing career at the age of 15, as well as talking to us about his books, his writing style, and his hopes for his future writing projects, as well as the future of the Alagaseya world. We're very grateful to James Rains for interviewing Christopher Paolini for us. So without further ado, here is James Rains interviewing author Christopher Paolini.
I'm super excited today to welcome our guest author, Christopher Paolini, the best-selling author of Aragon and the Inheritance Cycle. Christopher just finished up his tour in Alaska, hitting both Anchorage and Fairbanks at the Barnes & Noble, and now he's taken some time out of his busy schedule to meet with us. Hello, Christopher. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for having me here.
So, Christopher, would you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, I could probably spend a couple hours talking about that, but the short version is I grew up in Montana and Alaska. I've actually lived in Anchorage twice, although the last time was, it was pretty long ago. It was 1991. In fact, my sister was born in Alaska, so we always make fun of her for that. That's what's wrong with her, right?
Of course.
But I spent most of my childhood in Montana, and I was homeschooled my whole life because my mom is a Montessori teacher. And once I graduated from high school, I was really, really bored, and I decided to try writing the sort of story that I enjoyed reading, which, of course, was fantasy. So I spent a lot of time thinking up of a story with dragons and battles and villains and romance and magic swords. Started with a book called Aragon.
Could you tell us a little bit about what Aragon's about?
Aragon's the story of a young man named Aragon who finds a dragon egg out in the middle of the forest, and he becomes linked with this brilliant sapphire blue baby dragon named Saphira. And together they go on a series of adventures, and there are duels and dragons and battles and villains and all the good stuff a story needs. So if you're looking for an epic adventure and you like fantasy and and you like dragons, then these are books you would probably enjoy. And then continued with Eldis, Brisinger, and final book, Inheritance. The first book, Aragon, was adapted into a movie back in 2006, I believe, and I've been very, very fortunate to be able to pursue writing as a career, and I've sort of been doing that ever since.
Excellent. So you say you were homeschooled by your mom, who was trained in Montessori. Could you explain what Montessori method is for our readers?
Well, you'd have to ask her for the exact description, but my understanding of it is really hands-on with the children, and so lots of the lessons are geared toward giving you physical examples that you can get your hands on that make a big difference in how you understand, let's say, math. You know, with math, you know, you have physical blocks in front of you that you're learning how to add and subtract and divide with the physical block. The approach is really about allowing the children to pursue their own interests. Say you get interested in the pyramids for some reason when you're a kid. You would go to the library, get a bunch of books on the pyramids in Egypt, and do a little report on that subject. So I think it actually is a really good training for anyone who wants to be an author, because it teaches you a lot of basic skills you're going to need to have in order to write a book. You know, researching, pursuing your interests, not getting discouraged. And as I said, it also gave me a really good feel for subjects like math that would have been difficult for me to grasp if I were just working off of textbook rather than having the physical hands-on examples.
I was actually kicked out of a Montessori school. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Coincidentally enough, I was kicked out of my mom's Montessori school.
So I think that's actually worse than getting kicked out of somebody else's Montessori school.
Problem was that when I was very young, she was still teaching in school, and I was going to her class, and the difficulty for me is that all of a sudden my mother was no longer just my mother, she was teacher for the whole class.
Yeah.
And that just didn't fit well for me. You know? Those other kids didn't deserve her attention. I was not a model student. I ended up getting put in a separate room because I was so disruptive. I am glad I was not in a public school, because I do not take to authority too well, and if I were in a public school, I probably would have caused a lot of trouble, and it would not have been good for me or anyone around me.
What were some of the favorite things that you liked to learn?
Literature, of course. I don't think that would be any surprise for people. I loved reading, but I also loved other subjects. I loved history. I loved science. I still love science to this day. I read as much as possible about it. Not a huge fan of math, to be honest. I can use it and make it work for me, but it doesn't speak to me on a deep personal level. But I just tried to read and learn everything I could, and I think that's something that, you know, anyone who's in a creative field, whether you're a painter or a writer or a filmmaker, you know, it's incumbent upon you to learn as much as possible. And the more you learn, the more it enriches your writing. And that's something that is important to keep in mind, because especially as you get older and you have more responsibilities, it's hard sometimes to make time to go sit down and read a book or to go research something. And yet, if you make that time, you find that it increases your productivity and that it increases your sense of enjoyment in life and your understanding of things. So it's always a balancing act between responsibilities and yet the things you need to do in order to make your responsibilities enjoyable and enrich them and generally make life worth living.
What were some of the writers that inspired you when you were young?
Well, when I was very young, I read a bunch of children's books, some of the Beverly Cleary books, the Ramona books, and the Tom Swift books, and the Nancy Drew books, and things like that. Once I got up into my teens, I got into modern fantasy. I started with David Eddings, and then Raymond Feist, and then the Redwall series by Brian Jakes, Andre Norton, Anne McCaffrey, Ursula K. Le Guin, Tolkien, of course. And all of those fed my love of literature. And I was reading things outside of fantasy, Jane Austen, Tolstoy, those sorts of things. All of that sort of fed my love of stories and eventually inspired me to write my own books. Can't forget Dune by Frank Herbert. That's another classic.
Excellent. I feel like I should have gotten a pencil and wrote down this reading list.
It's fun to be doing this interview here with you in Alaska, because when I was living in Anchorage last time, back in 1991, it was actually that experience that helped me fall in love with reading. And this is a story I tell at all of the presentations I do, because up until that point, I hated reading. Hmm. My mom was teaching me, and she was doing a good job, but I hated reading, mainly because I didn't understand the relevance of it. I had no connection to the words on the page. It just felt like something I was forced to do when I would much rather have been running around outside and playing with my friends. But all that changed one day when my mom took me to the public library there in Anchorage. And as I was wandering around in the children's section, I found this series of really thin children's books. They were like little detective novels. And for the life of me, I can't remember the names of them. But there was one book in particular that had an interesting cover, so an interesting title. So I checked it out, and it was the first book I ever checked out from a library on my own. And when I started reading it, for some reason, it was as if a switch just got flipped in my head. And all of a sudden, instead of just seeing the words on the page, I could see the things they represented. Instead of seeing the word for sun, I could actually done in my mind. And that, to me, was like magic. And from that moment on, I just completely fell in love with reading and ultimately writing. But it all comes down to that one book there in Anchorage.
So you kind of mentioned a little bit about this, but where do you think your ideas come from when you're sitting down to write a new book or when you sat down to write your original books?
Well, my original books were directly inspired by all the fantasy books I read. Specifically, the first book, Aragon, was inspired by a young adult book called Jeremy Thatcher, Dragon Hatcher by Bruce Coville. And it's a great little book about a young man in the real world who goes into this beat-up old antique shop and finds a stone that he buys. And he takes it home, and the stone ends up hatching a dragon. It's actually an egg. And I love that idea so much of a young man finding a dragon egg that I spent a bunch of time asking myself questions like, you know, what sort of a world would a dragon live in? How might a young man find a dragon egg out in the middle of the forest? How did the dragon egg get there? Who else would be looking for the dragon egg? And so forth and so on. And one of the things I've learned is that stories, you know, worlds and characters, all of those things are really developed through the process of asking and then answering questions. The trick is you have to figure out all the questions you need to ask, and then you also have to try to answer them honestly. Because sometimes you ask a question and it makes you uncomfortable, or you don't know how to answer it, and you answer it in a way that is glib or facile or just dishonest, and you may not even realize it. And that's where you can get yourself into trouble. Past that, as far as ideas in general, ideas can come from anywhere. Sometimes I get them talking with my family or friends about, oh, hey, you know, I saw that movie and I really liked what they did in it and I wonder what would happen if da 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 da. Or I read this book and I really didn't like what they did and boy, wouldn't it be interesting if they did XYZ instead? Or sometimes it's just taking a walk and looking at the mountains and the light, some idea pops in my head or listening to a piece of music. The thing is that ideas are cheap. Everyone has ideas. Everyone has good ideas. It's execution that makes all the difference between a mediocre or a bad piece of art and a great piece of art. You could give the same idea to 10 different artists, and you'll get 10 different pieces of art back, and completely different pieces of art back from each of the artists. So ideas, while important, while very, very, very important, ultimately aren't the deciding factor into whether or not you're going to be a successful writer or musician or what have you. So the main key point, I think, is that when you start a piece of art, whatever it is, do not start it lightly. And by that I mean, you know, don't sit around agonizing over whether it's going to be great art or not, or whether it's going to be entertaining. That's not what you do. If you're going to start something, commit to doing it to the fullest extent of your abilities. And don't do it haphazardly. Don't do it carelessly. That's all I mean. If you're going to sit down and do it, you commit internally to doing it as well as possible, no matter how much work that may take. And if you do that with everything you attempt, quality of your work is going to be much, much better than if you just say, oh, hey, you know, I've got a cool idea. I think I can just whip this out and without thinking about it more and feeling it more.
So when you're sitting down with an idea and you've decided, okay, I want to go with this idea, I want to start writing the story out, do you feel that your idea takes on its own life as you begin to write?
Definitely, because an idea is not a story necessarily. An idea might be a feeling, a theme, a character, an image. A lot of times it's an image for me. I mean, let's say for my fantasy series, for the Inheritance Cycle, the image was a young man finding a dragon egg. Then the idea of the young man and the dragon going off on a series of adventures together. And that's a cool idea, but it's not a story. And so by asking all of those questions and then by working out the structure of the events and working out the characters and working out the setting, the world for the events to take place in, yes, it takes on its own life. And you discover things that you hadn't anticipated in the beginning, and those end up shaping what the story becomes. And the key point is to try to never lose the core thing that is the reason you're writing the story. And yet at the same time, not being so attached to it that if you come up with a better idea or a more important idea or something that fits the story better, that you're not going to allow yourself to change that if you need to change it. Because a lot of times artists become really attached to one idea or another, and it's hard for them to change it, and therefore you get an awkward story where some character is behaving the way they shouldn't just because that's the way the writer originally thought that's how they should behave.
Have you ever thought about teaching literature courses? I mean, you're doing an excellent job. I feel like I need to be taking notes. How important do you think it is to do research in a novel?
Research is simultaneously incredibly important and completely irrelevant because you want to know enough to not make a fool of yourself so that if someone who actually knows something about the topic you're writing about reads your book, they're not going to laugh at you and say, that guy just said you put the saddle of a horse on the head of the horse? What is he smoking? Or what have you. But at the same time, plenty of writers fall in the trap of doing so much research, they then feel that all this information they've learned is really, really important, and so they have to put all that information in their book. And it gets very, very boring for the reader as they're reading along, and all of a sudden the writer is describing all the stitching that is used in the construction of the saddle, when all you need to do is get your character on the horse, on the saddle, and go ride from point A to point B. So it's a balancing act. It's very easy to learn the vast majority of information on a topic. You know, like 80% of the knowledge of a topic is fairly easy to assimilate. The last 20% of the information is what's going to differentiate a layperson from an expert. And so my experience has been, okay, you need to learn something. Let's say it's, you know, sailing ships. You can get a couple of books. You can go on the internet. You can do your reading. And then when you write your first draft or your second draft or whatever, you give it to someone who actually knows what they're talking about when it comes to sailing ship. And they'll look at it and they'll tell you where you made your actual mistakes, right? But you get the vast majority of that through your reading first. And then you can just go write. So the trick is not to do so much research that it slows down the writing. Now, I'm currently, we can talk about this a little later, I'm currently writing a massive science fiction novel. I'm actually in edits and rewrites at the moment, and I spent a year doing research for the novel. Now, I would not do that for a standalone novel, but it's not just a standalone novel. It's a science fiction universe that is a setting that I can write novels in for the rest of my life if I want. So that year of research was worth it for me because I was figuring out all of the science, all of the technology, all of the ways in which things were going to work in my sci-fi universe, and that way when I sit down to write, I understand it. But I am not spending pages and pages explaining all the technology to the readers because that's boring.
Some can be very drawn out in the technical details, and you're just kind of skipping the pages to the dialogue. And
on the flip side, you have someone like Tom Clancy, who was, you know, really good at tension and writing page turners. And I remember one book of his where he has a nuclear bomb go off in the middle of a stadium, I think, and he stops the action right as the bomb's going off to explain to you the internal mechanism of a nuclear bomb and exactly how the bomb's going off. And he must have done a lot of research for it, but it's not boring. If anything, it increases the tension. So as with all rules in writing, there are exceptions, and if you know what you're doing, you can manipulate those rules.
If you're just tuning in with us, you're listening to Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA, and the Beyond the Cover segment where we're interviewing Christopher Paolini, best-selling author of the Inheritance book series, including the books Aragon, Eldest, Brisinger, and Inheritance, along with the supplemental Aragon's Guide to Alagaseya. Christopher Paolini recently visited both Fairbanks and Anchorage, Alaska to do book signings and discuss his books with fans, as well as taking the time out to do this interview with us on Beyond the Cover. Before we get back to James Raines' interview of Christopher Paolini, I'd like to play you a song that was featured in the 2006 movie version of Aragon, based on Christopher Paolini's novel. This song is called Keep Holding On, as performed by Avril Lavigne.
You're not alone, together we stand. I'll be by your side, you know I'll take your hand. When it gets cold and it feels like the end, there's no place to go, you know I won't give in. No, I won't give in. Doors close and it comes to an end. With you by my side, I will fight and defend. I'll fight and defend. Yeah, yeah. Keep holding on.
So let's talk about Aragon for a minute. What inspired you to write Aragon?
Well, boredom and a love of reading and writing. I graduated from high school at 15, mainly because I just never took any summer breaks, being homeschooled, really. So I graduated early, and I live in a pretty isolated part of rural Montana. So the nearest town is about a half-hour drive away, and I didn't drive at the time. I didn't have a job. I wasn't in school. So the question was, what am I going to do with myself? And I eventually decided to try to write a story I would enjoy. Since I loved fantasy, my thought was I wanted to do a love letter to the genre and include all the elements I loved about fantasy. So the magic sword, the wise old mentor, the evil villain, the dragon, dwarves, elves, etc. And the thing is I never thought Aragon was going to be published. I was very methodical as a teenager. I'm still very methodical. And I'd tried writing some stories before and never gotten past the first 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pages, mainly because I only had the idea for a story, not the actual structure of the story itself. Once I got past the initial set of events right at the beginning of the story, I just sort of hit a wall, and I didn't know what was supposed to happen next. As I said, I was very methodical. I spent a couple of months creating an entire fantasy world and plotting out an entire fantasy novel, and I did not write it. The whole point was simply to prove to myself that I could construct an outline for a story. And once I did that, I said, okay, I know I can plot a story. Now I'm going to come up with a world and a story for a trilogy, because of course, all great fantasy stories are trilogies.
Of course.
I am going to write the first book as a practice novel, just to see if I can write 200, 300, 400, 500 pages. And I was doing this because I'd read so many stories from other authors. It takes them 3, 4, 5 books before they get published. And I was completely prepared to do this. And I figured if I wrote a practice novel, this would then be a good experience for going on and writing a real book. And Aragon was my practice book. I spent a couple of months plotting out the whole trilogy, or it was a trilogy then, before it turned into 4 books. And then I actually wrote Aragon. And the thing is when you put that much time and effort and love into just one object, you can't just walk away from it. And once I finished that first draft, I realized, you know, hey, I really love this story and these characters, and I want to keep working with them, and I would like people to read this book. So I spent almost another year editing the book with my family, and then as a group, we decided to self-publish the book and take it around the western half of the United States and go to schools and libraries and bookstores and see if anyone was interested in actually reading this monstrously big book. And fortunately for me, they were, and I've been writing ever since. So I only got to write my quote-unquote real book 10 years later when I actually finished The Inheritance Cycle.
Can you explain the main character of Aragon?
The Inheritance Cycle, and the reason it's called Inheritance, is about a number of young people who are growing up and who are inheriting the roles and responsibilities of the previous generation. And the main character, Aragon, happens to find a dragon egg, and the dragon egg hatches a brilliant sapphire-blue baby dragon who he named Zephira. And of course, there are evil forces in the world who are searching for the dragon egg, and this sends the two of them on a series of adventures. But to me, fantasy is not just about, you know, running around and fighting enemies with swords and hacking and slashing and all of that. It can be. That's fun. That's part of why I like fantasy. But I also like fantasy because of that mythic element, you know, the fact that you can write about the bigger questions in life. And Aragon is growing up, and he is thinking about those bigger questions. Not in a depressing way, it's just something that he's dealing with as he's going through these very intense experiences. And so he's having to figure out his place in the world and what's right and what's wrong. And of course, doing all of this with this incredible dragon by his side who is his best friend and he can fly on and she can breathe fire and she can eat anyone he doesn't like. I think is a key component of a best friend. When they can eat someone you don't like, that's a best friend.
My favorite character was actually Roran, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Roran, yes.
And
I have a theory about Roran. Roran, for those of you who have not read the book, is Aragon's cousin, but they were raised together as brothers. And he's an ordinary man in the sense that he can't use magic. You know, he's not the chosen one from prophecy or anything like that. And yet, despite the fact that he doesn't have any special abilities or anything like that, he is just one of the real badasses of the story. He, in some ways, is based off my dad, I would think.
Okay.
And myself, to a degree. But he just never gives up. And he does some extraordinary things, and he's sort of like the Batman of their world in some ways. He was a lot of fun to write, and I think he's a lot of fun to read.
I love his hammers.
His special ability is that he never gives up.
Okay.
Not one.
I was always rooting for him, you know, because he goes through a lot of adult situations where he has to make big decisions.
He's a fun character. character because Aragon is a bit younger. So Aragon is really going through the process of becoming an adult from ground zero, if you will, whereas Rohan already is pretty much an adult, and he knows who he is and what he wants, and it's a different perspective and provides a nice counterbalance in the story from Aragon, who's always going around wondering, you know, who am I and what am I doing and how am I supposed to get from point A to point B? And Rohan knows. He knows what he wants. He knows how he's going to do it, and nothing's going to stop him.
Your website says that you're not done with Alagazia. Are you planning a new Aragon adventure sometime in the future?
This is hard for me to answer without giving spoilers. But,
okay.
It's safe to say that, yes, after spending over a decade working on the story in the world of the Inheritance Cycle, I do plan on returning to it at some point. Maybe not quite how people expect, but I do have a fifth book all plotted and planned out. I just need to write some other stuff first as a palate cleanser, if you will. And if people have read the last book, they'll probably notice that there were a couple of little small questions here and there around the edges of the story that were unanswered. And those questions are the framework and the foundation for future stories within the world.
Have you ever considered doing a prequel to the Aragon story, maybe taking your fans on a journey into the fall of the Dragon Riders?
It would be the story of Braum,
okay.
Aragon's mentor, who lives through that. The difficulty with it, sort of like as with the prequel Star Wars movies, everyone knows how it ends in some ways. So it would have to be a very well-written book in order to keep people interested in the story when they know what the final destination of the story is. But it is something I've considered, and it's something I may tackle once I'm a little older and more grizzled and a little bit more like the character of Braum myself.
I've also read on your site that you can order a signed copy of Aragon. How would our listeners go about doing that?
If people go to my website, which is paolini.net, they can find contact information for a local bookstore here in Montana. I have an arrangement with them, and I'll sign a book for you, personalize it, and I'll ship it off. Also, there's an address there if anyone wants to send me a letter with rants or raves or what have you. I'm always happy to interact with readers like that. And I can also be found on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all those good places. But the main website is, again, paolini.net.
So let's talk about the movie for a minute. What are your thoughts about the adaptation of your book to the big screen?
Well, it was really cool to have an adaptation because so few books ever get made into movies. And the movie introduced literally millions of new readers to the story, which as an author I think is a pretty cool thing. I gave as much input as I could into the making of the movie, but ultimately the film represents the vision of the story that the studio and the director had. And, you know, everyone's free to enjoy the film and the books on their own merits. Funny story, I was supposed to have a cameo in the movie, but I was touring around for the release of my second book, Eldest, at the time. So the timing didn't work out, but they were going to actually fly me out to Budapest where they were filming the movie, and I was going to have a cameo. This is what I asked for. The cameo was going to be in the big final battle in the movie, and I was going to get dressed up as one of the monsters in the movie and get my head chopped off by Eric on screen. So I'm still kind of sad that didn't happen. Possible there may be more movie adaptations in the future or a television show or something like that. Hollywood is kind of a weird place, so difficult to predict when or if that will happen. I would love to see that, of course, but it's sort of out of my hands.
If I remember seeing the first trailer, seeing John Malkovich, Jeremy Irons, and seeing some of the graphic effects and going, I'm going to the theaters to see this. I don't care where it's at, where I got to be, where I got to fly to. I'm going to see this movie.
They were definitely planning on a series, you know, but that didn't end up working out. So if they were to make another movie, they would have to be rebooted because none of the actors are, you know, under contract at the moment. And it's been so long, they'd have to recast in any case. But I know what you mean about seeing Malkovich and Robert Carlyle and Jeremy Irons and all the other actors. In fact, I got to attend the film premiere at the Odeon Theater in London, which is where they premiere the Harry Potter movies and the Bond films, and it was crazy. They'd set up these giant billboard dragons that were breathing fire outside of the theater, and there was this massive crowd, and, you know, I end up watching the movie sitting right next to Robert Carlyle, who plays the character of Durza in the movie, and just a surreal, surreal experience. And actually, more surreal than that was probably playing the video game adaptation of the film adaptation of my book. Sitting at home on the Xbox 360, controlling a 3D computer-generated version of the actor playing the character of Aragon in the movie, off my book, and he's saying lines that I wrote back when I was 16. That was strange.
What are your thoughts on Sienna Gilroy as Arya?
I met her at the premiere, and she's actually much more elf-like in person than she was in the movie.
Okay.
One of the things about the movie is if you watch the movie, you wouldn't even know that there are dwarves and elves in the book. I have no problem with her as an actress or as a person. I think that film just didn't do a great job of presenting either the elves or the dwarves, and they could have done a better job with her in that role. And in fact, one of the reasons they cast her is she was in the Resident Evil movies, and in those movies she had dark hair and looked very much more like the character was described in my book. And I think that's why they cast her, but I'm not sure why, you know, from an art design standpoint, they went with blonde hair and the look they did for the series.
So, you're famous at a young age, an inspiration to many. What happened next? What happened after Aragon and the Inheritance Cycle?
So, I self-published Aragon with my family at 17, and it came out with Random House at 18, 19. And I finished the last book. It came out in 2011, and I was touring for it all the way into late 2012. So, once I finished all that, it was rather traumatic. I expected it to be. I'd read enough and talked with enough authors to know that, you know, finishing a big series like that is a big life change. And it was. It was like finishing graduate school or something. You know, I got out of the series and kind of looked around and went, wow, what now? Unfortunately for me, I had plenty of other story ideas that I was able to keep working on. So it's not like I was suddenly going, gee, what am I going to write next? It was more a process of figuring out how to structure the rest of my life now that the focus of it had changed, because I'd structured my whole life around writing the books and finishing the books and touring with the books, and of course with the movie that took up a lot of time and energy as well. I wrote a bunch of short stories, I wrote a screenplay, which was horrible, absolutely horrible, but it was a fun experience. And then I geared up for my next big project, which is this science fiction book. And I've gotten to travel, which is one of the great things about this whole experience, is I've been able to go over to Europe and Australia and all over different places and have that experience. And of course, just recently, as you mentioned, I was up in Anchorage and then Fairbanks, which is the first time I have been back in Alaska in 25 years.
Do you have a different occupation other than writer?
No, actually, this has been my full-time occupation since I was 15, 16. And I've been very, very fortunate that enough people have enjoyed reading my books that I've been able to make this my profession.
So when I visit your website, which I do occasionally, I follow you on some of the social media, and back when Alagazia was the website, I would get your updates via email. And I remember you had a sword made, and I remember also some other time seeing some very fancy artwork and jewelry. Is that something that you do as well?
I did all of the interior art for the Inheritance Cycle, and I've done more pieces of art for various special editions. I originally was planning on being an artist, on being an illustrator, but I read so many stories about starving artists that I figured it would be better to become a writer, not realizing how many starving writers there are. But it did work out. But no, I love drawing and painting. I like making things with my hands. I've made knives. I've made swords. Yeah, and in fact, the sword you just mentioned, you may or may not have seen this. I've worked with the Make-A-Wish Foundation a couple of times, 4 or 5 times at this point. And I don't usually talk about it because, you know, privacy reasons, and it's not about me, it's about the child I'm interacting with. But in this case, it was kind of special because the young man in this instance, his wish was to have a replica of one of the swords from the Inheritance Cycle.
Okay.
Which, okay, that's cool in and of itself, but the sword he requested is a sword called Tinkle Death, and the entire sword in the books is made out of diamond. Blade, crossguard, handle, hilt, everything's made out of diamond. So, of course, we couldn't actually make something out of diamond like that, but I found a jeweler here in Montana and some craftsmen and a swordsmith and all of that, and we ended up making a completely transparent sword out of acrylic. We were going to use polycarbonate, but we couldn't find a big enough piece. I actually have an article up about this recently in some videos and pictures, and it's amazing. This thing looks like a magic sword. You know, it's actually sharp. It can actually cut you. And it has a silver-wrapped handle and a leather-tooled sheath, and it's just absolutely amazing. And I think the young man is going to be completely blown away when he gets it in actually just a couple of days here. I know I was looking at it and thinking, wow, if I were, you know, back when I was a kid, if I'd gotten something like that, it would have been the best thing ever. And it's still pretty awesome even now as I'm no longer a teenager. So I try to do things like that. You know, as I said, the readers, the fans have been absolutely amazing for me. So anytime I can give back to them, whether through a signing or doing something like the Make-A-Wish Foundation, whatever it is, I always try to do that because, again, if not for the readers, none of this would be possible.
It's time to move out of the dark.
with what you feel inside. Your faith alone will guide you. Feel the turning tide. It's in your heart, it's in your soul. Don't be scared, keep believing. I know you know deep inside that your time has come. Once in every
listening to Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA, where James Rains is interviewing Christopher Paolini, the best-selling author of the Inheritance book series, including Aragon, Eldest, Brisinger, and Inheritance, along with Aragon's Guide to Alagaseya. I just played you another song from the 2006 movie adaptation of the Aragon story. This song was called Once in Every Lifetime, as performed by Jem. If you're interested in finding out more information about Christopher Paolini and the Inheritance Cycle books, please visit the Paolini website at paolini.net, spelled P-A-O-L-I-N-I.net, where you'll find descriptions of all of Christopher Paolini's books, along with bios, frequently asked questions, blogs, and a lot of other fantastic information. That website, again, is paolini.net. Now let's get back to the Beyond the Cover interview with Christopher Paolini and hear about his future plans for a science fiction novel here on Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA.
I'm getting very excited about our next topic. You are currently working. I've been watching your videos, so I've been seeing the notebooks you've been filling. You are currently working on not a, but the science fiction novel. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the science fiction novel might be overstating it slightly. I'm sure some other authors might have some things to say about that. But yeah, I decided to try to write a science fiction novel that is a love letter to science fiction, just like Aragon was a love letter to fantasy. And it's a sort of equal parts of the Alien film, Starship Troopers, Dune, the Hyperion series by Dan Simmons. It's a big space opera with lots of spaceships and explosions and aliens and lasers and tentacles. Don't forget the tentacles. And it's pretty much consumed my life over the past few years. But I'm getting closer to having it actually be done, which is exciting. And I do think the people who enjoyed The Inheritance Cycle will enjoy it just as much, if not more, than Aragon and the other books. One of the fun things for me is, after spending so long writing fantasy, it's really, really awesome as a writer to now to be able to use modern words. I mean, there's so much stuff you can't use writing fantasy because it just doesn't fit the genre. Like, you can't say backpedaled because that comes from bicycles. You can't say end of the line or car or, you know, there's so many phrases and words. So it's really liberating for me to be able to use the language I'm used to in my everyday life in the science fiction novel.
With this new book, do you now, after your fame, have your own agents, your own publishing company that have already decided to pick this book up, or is it something you're going to be looking for in the future?
I've worked with the same agent since the beginning. His name is Simon Lipscar at Writer's House, and he's a wonderful, wonderful agent. So I will still be working with him. I have not actually sold the book to a publisher at the moment because after, again, over a decade of working to deadlines, I hate working to deadlines, but I very much hope to keep working with my same publisher at Random House because they've been wonderful to me, and I love them, and they're awesome people, and so forth and so on. But nothing's quite settled at the moment. Ultimately, it's going to be a business decision in finding the best, you know, home for the book. But as I said, I'm pretty sure that'll be Random House because they've been my publishing home this whole time.
Do you have any amusing stories about your time out and about marketing your book?
Boy, how long do you have? I have had some amazing and crazy experiences, both with the self-published edition of Aragon and every single one of the books that Random House has released with me. When I was with the self-published edition, I had a young man come up to me in a school and tried to sell me, what were they, marmots or weasels? No, weasels. Weasels. He was selling them to raise money for his family, which I can respect, you know, raising money for your family like that. When I was getting ready for the book tour for the second book, Eldest, actually, I was supposed to be getting ready for the book tour. I was actually just sitting at home playing video games.
Okay.
And I was playing a video game called Jedi Knight Academy 2, which was a great Star Wars game. It had some of the best lightsaber combat of any video game. And so I'm playing online and fighting all these people around the world, and someone logged into the game using the name Aragon. And of course, you know, I had to go fight them. I just had to.
Of course.
And so I challenged him to a duel, and we had a fight and all of that. And the horrible thing is he was better than me. And across the screen it said, "You have been killed by Aragon."
Excellent, excellent.
I did an event one time in Vancouver or somewhere, and I had a woman who flew in from Australia just for the book signing.
Oh, wow.
I found this out when she fainted in the middle of the presentation. She was so excited she fainted. Had a bunch of people fainting. Got a bunch of marriage proposals. Although one time, after someone said, you know, marry me or something, I looked out the audience and I said, what would you do if I actually said yes? And this woman got a thoughtful expression, and she said, well, she said, I know some good bars nearby we can go hang out at. But mainly, I think the most incredible experiences are just hearing from all the readers who have been touched by the books over the years. There have been people who grew up with the books and who have named their children after characters, which really I find astounding and very humbling. I had one woman when I was touring for the third book, and she came through the signing line, and she was carrying a sugar glider. For those who don't know, sugar gliders are kind of like flying squirrels, but they're marsupials, and they're really, really, really cute. So I looked at the sugar glider, and I did what any normal person would do, and I said, oh, that's so, 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 so cute. Do you mind if I pet it? And she said, oh, sure, go right ahead. He loves strangers. So, you know, I reach over and I start petting the sugar glider, and it looks up at me and it takes its hands, because they have hands sort of like a raccoon, and it just wrapped its fingers around my finger, and then ever so politely, it began to gnaw on my hand. And so I was sitting there with blood running down my finger in the middle of a book signing, trying to say, you know, will you please stop your pet from trying to eat me? But, you know, know, it makes for a good story, and that means I'm one of the few people outside of Australia who can now say they've been chewed on by a marsupial. So it's been a really amazing and crazy experience. I had one fan come up and ask me to sign their forearm with a Sharpie, so right on their skin. And then they showed up the next day, and they'd gotten my signature tattooed onto their arm. I'm a big fan of other authors as well, and I can't think of a single one I'm a big enough fan to get a tattoo with their signature, yeah.
I might ask Stephen King to write on a Sharpie on my arm, just because it's Stephen King, but, you know, tattooing
no,
it on...
No. You give Stephen King a sterilized needle, and you ask him for a drop of blood on your book. That's what you ask Stephen King.
Oh, okay. Hey... If I ever bump into him, that's exactly what I'm going to ask for.
And you can tell him I told you to do it.
That's exactly who I'm going to tell him that told me to do it. All right, so as we close, I want to ask for you personally, what is the hardest thing about writing?
Consistency. Persistence is one of the most useful traits anyone can have, and especially when it comes to large projects like writing books. But it's hard. You know, it's even to this day, it can be really hard to sort of sit down and work on the same thing day in, day out when there are so many other easier things you could be doing, like playing video games or hanging out with your friends or whatever it might be. But the thing is that, you know, if you want to complete a large project, you have to work on it pretty much every day. And if you want to improve your skills, you have to do the same, just like practicing a musical instrument. And that's why I always say that if you want to be a writer, it needs to be something you truly love and enjoy. And you need to be writing about a topic that you truly love and enjoy, because that's what's going to give you the motivation to sit down every day and work on it. Also helps when it is your profession and your career, and books sold means food on the table. That is a surprisingly motivating force right there. Yeah, that's probably the hardest thing. And, you know, even to this day, it's easy for me to sometimes think, oh, you know, I've got this idea, I'm just going to whip it out. Doesn't happen. There's so much work that goes into it behind the scenes that the readers never see. And the readers shouldn't see that work. But if the writer doesn't put the work in, it shows in the final product. And I can tell you, I've picked up many, many, many books and started reading them. And within a couple of pages, a couple of chapters, I can tell, okay, maybe they had a cool idea. Maybe the writing's even really good line by line, but I can still tell that the basic work was not put into whether the characters or the world or the story or whatever it might be. So that's the hardest part. And the way to deal with it, I think, is to provide yourself with variety in your life. You know, spending time with friends, reading lots of books, watching movies, playing games, taking walks outside, lifting heavy things. Whatever it is that recharges your batteries and allows you to sit down again at your work the next day and feel, if not excited, at least determined and hopeful that you're going to make good progress. For aspiring writers, I would also add on, so reading and writing consistently, writing about something that you absolutely love, whatever that might be, learning everything you can about the language you're writing in, because that is the tool of the trade, and the better you understand it, the better you'll be able to get what's in your head onto the page and into someone else's head. And then I'm also a really big fan of outlining your story before you start to write, because otherwise, it's like music. You know, it's very hard to perform a piece of music while you compose it, or vice versa, compose it while you perform it. It's much easier to compose it first and then concentrate on performing it later. And that's really what writing is. Writing is a performance. So outline your story beforehand. Make sure that, you know, outline it to the point where you could sit down with a friend or family member and you could tell the story to them verbally, just like a story around a campfire. And it would make sense, and it would be entertaining. And if you can do that, then you understand your story well enough to actually write it. And if you don't, you're going to get into trouble while writing. And then lastly, find someone in your life who is a good reader, who likes the sort of thing that you're trying to write, who can help edit your work. Because as painful as editing is, I guarantee you will learn more from editing than you ever will from actually writing. And that's because it's very, again, a musical analogy here. It's very hard when you're a singer to hear when you hit a bad note or when you hit an off note, a little bit of an off tone or something. And that's why every singer has a voice coach. Editors are voice coaches for writers. And of course, the more you write and the more you read and the more you get experience, the better as an editor you're going to be for yourself. But no matter how much experience you have, you'll still have certain blind spots with your own writing. And that's where the editor can come in and say, you know, this really doesn't work. Or, you know, this is okay, but what if you tried XYZ? Or, you know, great story, great characters, but boy, you have got a bunch of repeated words in this section, and you need to cut out this one and this one and this one and this one. Don't give up. It's really easy to give up. Everyone wants to give up at one point or another. I've met authors who have literally published more than 100 novels. Alan Dean Foster is one of them. And each one of them that I've met, I've asked them, I've said, so tell me, you know, you've published over 100 novels. Does it ever get any easier? And to a person, they have all looked at me and laughed and said, nope. I start writing a book, and it's my 110th book, and I get halfway through, and I start feeling like I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm a fraud, and no one wants to read my books, and I'll never be able to finish this project. And then I just keep working, and I finish the book, and everything turns out okay.
Wow, that's definitely some excellent insight. So thank you very much, Christopher, for participating in our radio show. It's been a privilege to pick your brain about your books and about writing and about your future works. Again, I just want to thank you.
Well, thank you. This has been a real pleasure, and it was a real pleasure getting to visit Alaska again recently and stay up till 1 or 2 in the morning, and it's still light in the sky, which is one of my favorite memories from living in Anchorage. Pleasure. You've asked some really interesting questions, and I hope that if people who've not read my books pick them up, that they will enjoy them. And those of you who have read my books, I hope you enjoy my future ones even more than The Inheritance Cycle. And as Aragorn himself would say in the language of the elves, Sionar Sverdar Sitya Havas, or may your swords stay sharp.
Well, that was a fantastic interview we had with Christopher Paolini here on Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales. And I'd like to say a very big thank you to Christopher for taking the time to interview with us. And also a thank you to James Rains for doing the interview. We're very happy that this local author has decided to help out with the Dog-Eared Reads show. If any of you listeners out there would also like to help out with Dog-Eared Reads in any way, be it doing an interview for us or providing us with book reviews or helping with the editing process, we would love to have your help. Please contact KPLA at kpla.alaska@gmail.com. Express your interest to volunteer with us, and we would be happy to get back to you. You can also fill out a volunteer application if you're interested in volunteering with any aspect of the KPLA. We have a volunteer application form on our website, which is www.kodiakpubliclibraryassociation.org. Now let's get to a little book review that Leanne has done for us about another fantasy novel that she really enjoys called Villains by Necessity. Here's Leanne.
Hi, this is Leanne Schmelzbach, and I'm here today to talk to you about one of my all-time, in my definitely top three novels that I love, Villains by Necessity by Eve Forward, published in 1995. If you go to look for this book, it's actually a very difficult thing to find, so your public library is going to be your best friend, because I'm fairly certain they have a copy. If not, they probably can find a copy for you. The book is out of print. If you go to buy it, of course, it's going to cost a pretty penny. There's some hardback available, and there's very few paperback available. I got lucky, and I purchased a couple of used copies about 5 years ago. And so I will have access to this novel forever. One of the things that makes Villains by Necessity one of my all-time favorite fantasy reads is because it takes the idea of good versus evil and it stands it on its head. In many traditional fantasy novels, you have the heroes who are brave and loyal and pure of heart, and they go on their quest to stop the evil from overwhelming humanity. Well, in Villains by Necessity, what happens is you walk into this world that's full of good, and you meet Samalander, who probably should have been named Salamander, but no one can spell because they're villains. But Samalander is an orphaned guy who has become the king of the Assassin's Guild, except there's nobody else in the guild. Something has happened to all of the other assassins, and he's not quite sure what. So he decides to go out and find out what has happened to all the other assassins. And in that quest, he also needs to discover what has happened to the Thieves Guild and to the Beggars Guild and to all the guilds that are associated with evil. Well, what Sam learns is that for some reason, villains have stopped being villains. And the world is extra bright and people are extra good. And he realizes that if he and his troop of villains don't figure out what's going on and put a stop to it, then the world is going to be obliterated by good. Now, that idea is just hilarious. But as you go through the story, there's a thief an assassin, a dark sorceress, a dark knight, a druid, the last of her kind, and there's a couple other little characters, a centaur who is the bard to document all of this, and there's one more character, and she is, if I remember correctly, she might be part of the Ladies of the Night realm. And she kind of pops in and out of the story. And then, of course, there's the good side. They're the good guys, the heroes, the knights of the round table, if you will, who have been conquering evil and vanquishing it and making sure that all things related to evil are ruined and getting, you know, vanquished from this world. Well, if you know anything about druids, the basic druid premise was the belief in balance, the balance of good and evil, the balance of light and dark, the balance of nature and man. And so the druid is a central figure in the story as she is trying to figure out how to help the world return to balance because there's too much good in the world. That premise in and of itself seems absurd to me, and it just makes me laugh every time I even think of it. But the writing itself is so well done. It's funny, it's suspenseful, it's filled with action, and the fact that it's seven villains of evil fighting the forces of good just makes you think. So, if you want a good read that is total fantasy, total brain bubblegum, but is one of those things that you'll want to read again and again, then Villains by Necessity by Eve Forward, published in 1995, is the fantasy novel for you.
Thanks, Leanne, for that great book review. And that wraps up our show today of Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA. Thank you, listeners, for checking us out, and I hope you enjoyed this fantasy-based episode. If you're interested in listening to past episodes of Dog-Eared Reads, you can always find us on the KMXT website, which is kmxt.org. Click on the Dog-Eared Reads link and you'll find a way to listen to all of our past episodes. And of course, please tune in again next month. We're on at 9 p.m. on the second Tuesday of the month here on KODK 90.7. Once again, thanks for listening. I'm Athenia, host and producer of Dog-Eared Reads and chair of the Kodiak Public Library Association, and I'm wishing you happy reading. Good night.
Simple little beauty, heaven in your breath, the simplest of pleasures, the world at its best.